So last week wasn't just an introduction, and we looked at some of the idea of soteriology in India, and we looked at briefly the post-colonial critique of Western constructions of India, but we also looked at the persistence of the concept of moksha and liberation as a theme in Indian texts and Hindu traditions, and as one of the human purposes or goals of life. And indeed, the opening verses of important texts such as the Samkhya Karikas and Nyaya Sutras explicitly state that the ultimate destination of philosophical inquiry is liberation from suffering and rebirth. So, in the handout, I've got something, a general phenomenological structure of moksha. And that philosophical traditions do take seriously the idea of liberation. Although in one sense it's a trick, you read Sanskrit texts and also this is for the purpose of liberation and so on, and then they just go on to argue with each other about various philosophical and epistemological problems. But I think they generally do take seriously the notion of liberation. Yeah, sure.
Last week's handout.
So there's a general idea. This will be ABC for some of you, but some of you it won't be. So it's intended for those for whom it's not ABC. general idea of freedom is freedom from suffering, dukkha, which is the same in the Shramana traditions as well. And at its deepest level, it arguably means something like dissatisfaction or alienation from what you truly are, from your true nature. And suffering is understood in terms of a delusion and cognitive affliction. And knowledge or correct cognition dispels such afflictions. That's the idea, but it's not obvious, really, why ignorance...
You mean definition in a sentence? I missed it.
It's probably written down. Alienation from what one truly is.
Thank you.
From your true nature, as it were. So, the Buddha was good. He analysed suffering down into various components. And there's all dukkha, ordinary suffering, like a brick falls on your head or something. And then there's the parinama dukkha, suffering due to attachment to that which is passing away, conditioned states. And then there's a third kind of suffering for the Buddhists, which was suffering due to constructions. In fact, that underlies all the others, I think. But the Buddhists are good on the analysis of suffering. They're better than the Samkhya tradition and the Hindus, probably. So it was ordinary suffering. But, I mean, so the semantic range of dukkha is more than just bricks falling on your head or stubbing your toe. It's kind of has the quality of dissatisfaction or alienation from its true nature. And it's understood in terms of delusion and cognitive affliction. And it's understood as ignorance, self-deceit, mistaken identity, identification with the body, identification with the subject of first-person predicates for Samkhya, and freedom is a direct understanding of a deeper identity of who you, your deeper self, or who you truly are. And that suffering comes through false identification. This is kind of a common theme in these traditions. And this deeper identity is conceptualized in different and mutually exclusive ways in the Indian traditions. So, in the Samkhya we'll be looking at today, it's understood as a numerically distinct self, unconnected with matter. In Advaita Vedanta, it's understood as a totality of unitary being, or it's understood as an individual entity in relation to some transcendent power, so some Bhakti traditions, or it's understood as recognition of consciousness only, as a Pratyabhijna, which we'll be looking at. Or as a realization of one's non-identity, as in Buddhism, that there is no essence, no self, and that the self is a construction. So who you really are is conceptualized in very different ways in the different traditions, and indeed they argue with each other over this issue. So becoming free is freedom from, depending on the metaphysical system you inhabit, really. But what's interesting is that they do have this notion of dukkha and this notion of freedom from. And becoming free is sometimes conceptualized as a healing process, and Halbfass points out the parallels between this philosophical soteriology and the therapeutic discourse in India, where the goal was the restoration of an original natural state, svastya. And indeed, I can't remember the reference or anything, but I think in Buddhism, the Buddha's Four Noble Truths were based on the analogy of a healing process. So the Four Noble Truths of suffering, the cause of suffering, the path, the end of suffering, and the cessation of suffering, and the path, the end of suffering, parallels a sort of doctor's prescription. You know, what's wrong? You've got a thorn in your foot or whatever. You have a pain in your foot. Look at the First Noble Truth parallel, if you like. Then what's the cause? Say a thorn in your foot. The end will be the removal of the thorn, and the way, the Fourth Noble Truth, the path, is the way to get the thorn out. So likewise, you have these teachers seeing themselves as kind of healers in some way, and I think that's true in some of the other Indian traditions as well. But as I mentioned last week, in the early speculation, the notion of moksha is absent from the early Vedic texts, which are not concerned with liberation from rebirth. And we looked last time at the Vedic model of the afterlife, which was a different model of preventing re-death in the next world and the construction of the body of the ancestors. Do you remember that? I won't go through that again, but you've got these three levels. You've got the Pretaloka and the Pitriloka, and you construct a body of the deceased in the next world. And that's still the case in popular ritual. And after funeral rites, the soul of the deceased goes to the realm of the ancestors, the ghosts rather, where its body is sustained or created by these shraddhas, and then goes to the Pitriloka after a period of time. And these rites continue for 10 days, recapitulating the 10 lunar months of gestation, at which time the ghostly body is complete. And then the Supindakarana rites move the deceased to the realm of the ancestors. Now, at village level, there's often no coherent belief about afterlife, for example, in Kerala folk belief. A person has two powers, or shaktis, which separate at death. The soul, or the life force, the ayus, goes to heaven, which is called svargam or moksham. They're interchangeable. While the other power remains in the earth as a ghost, a preta, a pishacham, or even as a crow. And there was one old lady, I probably told you this, that Rich Freeman and myself asked about what happens when you die. She said part of you goes into the earth, part of you goes to heaven, and part of you becomes a crow. So she had this tripartite division of a person. You know. And that perhaps illustrates a leftover from an earlier sort of age. So the notion of reincarnation and rebirth, although it is very important and prevalent in India, it's not universal, and at folk levels there are often quite a wide variety of understandings. And then that contrasts, of course, the Pindar model, if you like, contrasts with the Upanishadic model, and liberation, the idea of liberation which develops in the Upanishads. So the Brahmanas, the early texts of Brahmanas, were concerned with establishing hidden connections between the cosmos and the sacrifice. And the Upanishads are concerned with what this means. So the true sacrifice means the fire ablation of the breath, a sacrifice to the self within the self. And the true purpose of sacrifice is not the performance, not karma, but knowledge, jnana, of its meaning, which points to an underlying foundation or underlying being. And this being is the essence of the ritual. It's also the essence of the cosmos and the essence of the self. And it's called Brahman and identified with the sacred sound Om. So the word Brahman means the power that originally meant the power of the sacrifice. And its range gets extended in the Upanishads to mean the power of the universe, the power underlying the universe. And there it's identified with the mantra the Bija mantra. So in the Brahmanism, this Brahman is the power of the ritual, and it became to refer to the essence of the universe. So in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, King Janaka asked Yajnavalkya about the essence of the universe, whether it's speech, vital breath, the eye, the mind, or the heart. And Yajnavalkya replied that it's Brahman, which is the deepest support of these. And in the Upanishads, you get developed this idea of an impersonal monism. For example, in the Chandogya Upanishad. And that dialogue, you probably know the passage between Udalaka and his son Shvetaketu, the Tattvamasi passage, you are that. He says to his son, go and get me some water, put salt in it, and then when the son drinks the water, the salt pervades the water, so Brahman pervades the universe. And you are that, Tattvamasi. Now, the origins of karma and rebirth first occur in the Hindu tradition within the Upanishads. And there were ideas probably circulating amongst the Shramana traditions, as I mentioned last week. And they probably have their origins in the Shramana traditions, although some argue that the logic of rebirth and karma comes out of the actual Vedic tradition itself. There's some speculation in the Vedas. Death in the Rig Veda, in the Rig Veda 10.16, you have different parts of the body go to different places. So the eyes go to the sun, the breath, which here is the word Atman is used for breath, the breath goes to the wind, and the essential person goes to the ancestors. So you do get some speculation about where you go after death there. But the origin is arguably outside of the Vedic fold, and possibly in the Dravidian south even, but we're just not sure. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, retributive action is a little known doctrine, appears to be secret. And in the passage that I've given to you, I don't know if you've all got one, I don't think Chris, you've got one. This is the first occurrence. Artabhaga asks Yajnavalkya about the fate of a person at death. Echoing the Rig Veda, he asks what becomes of a person after the parts have dissipated, and Yajnavalkya leads him to a private place and tells him not to divulge this secret doctrine that meritorious action leads to merit, punya, while evil action leads to other evil, papa. A later text spell out this theory more explicitly. So we've got it. What have you got in front of you? Okay, so I think you need another. Sorry. I put a photocopy, it doesn't really matter, but. I've done more copies of the same thing.
Okay.
So some of you should have two pages. Some of you need two pages. On page 37 at the bottom there, 2.12, Yajnavalkya, Artabhaga said again, tell me, when a man dies, what is it that does not leave him? His name, replied Yajnavalkya, a name is without limit, and all the gods are without limit. Limitless also is the world, he wins by it. Yajnavalkya, Artabhaga said again, tell me, when a man has died, and his speech disappears into fire, his breath into the wind, the word Atman there is used, his sight into the sun, his mind into the moon, his hearing into the quarters, his physical body into the earth, his self into space, the hair on his body into plants, the hair on his head into trees, and his blood and semen into water. What then happens to that person? Yajnavalkya replied, my friend, we cannot talk about this in public. Take my hand, Artabhaga, and let's go and discuss this in private. So they left and talked about it. And what did they talk about? They talked about nothing but action, karma. And what did they praise? They praised nothing but action. Yajnavalkya told him, a man turns into something good by good action and into something bad by bad action. Thereupon, Artabhagya fell silent. So, yeah, there we are. That's the first occurrence, to my knowledge, of the idea of retributive action in Hinduism. Really. So later texts spell out the theory more clearly, that the self moves from body to body as a caterpillar moves from one blade of grass to another. At 4.4.3 you have that. And this is firmly established in later texts, such as the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, by about 400 to 200 BC, states that the performer of action, which bears the fruit, wanders in a cycle of transmigration according to his actions. So by that date, you've got a fully-fledged doctrine of karma and reincarnation. Now, associated with this doctrine, we've got the idea of renunciation, that if action keeps you bound, then the renunciation of action leads you to freedom, especially if the true meaning of ritual is its internalization. Then giving up ritual action in favour of knowledge of the inner sacrifice is the superior thing to do. So there's a cluster of associated ideas. Karma comes to refer to all meaningful action, not just ritual action. And all actions have effects not only in this life, but in future lives. And these effects mean that we suffer. We can get away from suffering through renunciation or detachment from action. And this detachment leads to freedom. So you stop acting, and that leads to freedom. It's the opposite of existentialism, really, we're looking at next lecture. So how is this achieved? Through detachment, which itself is achieved by focusing on a single point, yoga. And you get a reinterpretation of ritual, the internalization of the sacrifice. True sacrifice is the sacrifice of the breath. So you get that idea very strongly in the Upanishads. It's the internalization of the sacrifice and a complete reconceptualization of what ritual means. Now, embedded within these early texts, within these Upanishadic texts, are speculation, which is also in the epics as well, particularly in the Mahabharata and in the Gita, are various speculations about the nature of the world and the nature of liberation. And their attempts to offer descriptions of the constituents of the universe and the human person within it, paralleling the Greek world as well. And these speculations have become to be associated with the name Samkhya. Samkhya means enumeration. Now, it's generally used in the sense of enumeration or calculation in the renouncer traditions to denote the categorization of the elements of the cosmos. And more specifically, it refers to a philosophical system. There's a journal called Samkhya, which is an Indian journal of mathematics, if I recall. So giant Buddhist and early Brahmanical speculation and medical speculation arise out of this common ideological context. So in the early Upanishads, reflect speculation about the nature of the universe and the categorization of different elements within the universe. And that kind of categorization, that kind of process, feeds into the Shramana traditions, into Buddhism and Jainism, and also into the medical traditions within India. And there are striking parallels between Samkhya philosophy, Ayurveda, and Buddhist systems, particularly the Abhidharma and the Yogacara traditions. So early Samkhya-like speculations are found in the Chandogya Upanishad, which you can look up, 725 and then 624, where the colours red, white and black are identified with the elements fire, water and earth. And the text also mentions the idea of the self, similar to the I, the ego, the ahankara. Another Upanishads contains some material, but especially the Gita, which describes Krishna's nature as eightfold, comprising earth, water, fire, wind, ether, mind, intellect, and ego. That's Bhagavad Gita 7.4. Now, Kapila is the sage who is said to have founded the Samkhya system as such, and is generally associated with renunciation. In the Baudayana Dharma Sutra, 2:11-28, Kapila is a demon, an asura, who invents a system against the gods, perhaps reflecting a tension between the Vedic householder values and the values of renunciation. So that tension occurs throughout the text. As I said last time, the Shramanas and the Brahmanas were said to have a relationship like a snake and a mongoose. If you associate Shramanas with renunciation traditions, then there's a tension between the householder tradition and the Shramana tradition, or renunciation tradition, which are attempted to be reconciled in texts such as the Gita, which say you can actually act in the world but also be renounced at the same time. So another story along these lines which reflects a kind of tension like this in the Mahabharata is a dialogue between Kapila and a cow. And the cow is being led to sacrifice, and Kapila exclaims in horror about this. Oh, it's terrible that you're sacrificing this cow. And there's a sage, a sage enters into the body of a cow and speaks to Kapila and engages in debate of which is better, the life of renunciation or the householder's life. And the cow defends the householder's way of life as being the support of all the other ways. So the sage, through the cow, says actually the householder's life is best because it supports renunciation. You can't renounce without householders, which is true in a sense. I mean, the whole Buddhist Sangha relies on the householders to support it. So you get that kind of debate, and you also get very early speculation about the elements that constitute the universe. But a systematic philosophy doesn't develop until Ishvara Krishna's verses on Samkhya, the Samkhya Karikas, which are probably about 350 to 450 CE. So, you know, a thousand years later. There's also an eloquent exposition in Madhava's Sarvadarshana Sangraha, the compendium of all philosophies, which is composed in the 14th century. Now, what is this Samkhya system? The Samkhya is a radical dualism between self and matter, with which it appears to be entangled. So the self is tangled up in matter, and the goal of life is liberation, or the separation of the self from matter. So liberation is a discriminative knowledge that pure consciousness is eternally distinct from primordial matter. There's only a proximity between them, and realization of which leads to the cessation of suffering and reincarnation. And this liberation is conceptualized as isolation, kaivalya, of the soul from matter. So that's one of the earliest speculations about liberation, is isolation, kaivalya. And viveka, discrimination, allows us to differentiate between what is the self and what is not the self, and so to perceive that the self was never actually bound to matter. There's lots of problems with Samkhya. I mean, what's the relation between Purusha, the self, and Prakriti, matter, if they never actually contact each other? And if the self was never really bound, what is that relationship? And the self is the silent witness. The silent witness behind the first person pedagogue. So when I say I want a drink of water, it's not the Purusha that's speaking, it's still within matter, it's the ego within matter. So Prakriti is a much wider conception than the English word matter, because it includes what is described in the West as the mind as well. So it's a kind of materialistic in a way understanding of mental constructions and the mind, but it's positing an immaterial self behind all that as a silent witness, but it's not the subject of first person predicates. So Prakriti evolves from an unmanifest state to a manifest state through a series of levels in which these different categories appear, and these categories or tattvas comprise the universe of our experience. And this evolution or transformation is kept in balance by three qualities or gunas, namely light, passion or energy, sattva, rajas, tamas, darkness or inertia. And what's interesting is that the psychology and cosmology are kind of linked together in this system of the tattvas. And it's also an atheistic system, Nirishvara. So I think perhaps the most important, significant thing about the tattvas is that you get the link between individual mental construction and the world that you inhabit. So as is the state of mind, this is the kind of a notion that as the state of mind is, so is the world. So chitta and loka are interconnected. This is brought out explicitly in the yoga systems that we'll be looking at. So on the back of that handout, you've got the Samkhya tattvas there. So you've got the Purusha, which is the pure self, which is detached and isolated. And then you've got Prakriti, which is matter, which is avyakta, unmanifest, and vyakta, manifest. And in its avyakta state, it contains these qualities of sattva, rajas, and tamas in quiescence, and then they become agitated, and they manifest the universe in the vyakta state. As from the manifest prakriti develops the buddhi or the mahat, the great one. And this term buddhi can be very. I've seen various translations. It's translated as intellect, but also higher mind. And I've even seen it translated as unconscious, because the buddhi contains two things: the pratyayas and the bhavas, the causal conditions which give rise to lower manifestations. And it's said to be like a mirror, reflecting both ways. It reflects the purusha and reflects the lower manifestation. So the buddhi, if we look at this in terms of a cosmology, a hierarchy of levels in the universe, the buddhi, or the great one, is an emergent consciousness, if you like, coming out of prakriti. It's a bit like nous, I always think, in the Greek world. And out of the buddhi develops the ahankara, the eye-maker, the ego, which seems to me to be both a cosmological level and also an individual level. So we all of us have these, but then also it seems to me it's also operating at a level beyond the individual. And out of the ahankara, you get these other evolutes developing the mind, the manas, the five senses, hearing, touching, seeing, tasting, and smelling, the five karmendriyas, the five action capacities, speech, speaking, handling, walking, evacuation, reproduction, and that's an analysis of a human being for the Samkhyas. And then you get the five subtle elements arising, the sound, touch, colour, taste, smell, which are actually the objects of the five senses. And from those five subtle elements, the gross elements develop. And that link is not precisely clear to me, to my mind, that space emerges out of sound, air from touch, fire from colour, water from taste, and earth from smell. So you've got both an analysis of a human being here, plus an analysis of the universe, merged together, fused together, in a way which I leave you to think about the coherence of, whether the system hangs together, whether it's coherent or not. So you've got this very sort of precise analysis of the nature of the world in these tattvas and the cosmos, and the goal is to discriminate viveka between the purusha and prakriti. The goal is the isolation of the self from all of that. So prakriti is singular, is one, whereas the purushas are many. There are innumerable purushas, infinite number of purushas. And isolation is realization of the separation, the isolation of purusha from everything else. So the prakriti never really touches purusha. I suppose one way of looking at it is a bit like Leibniz's monad, so the purushaism, the perception is a property of the monad, is a property of the self. So possibly the perception of the property of the purusha. because there's never real contact between Purushas, and there's never real contact between the Purusha and matter. It just realizes its original isolation from everything. Now the Buddhists will come along and say, well, what's the point of that? You've got an analysis of the world in terms of Prakriti, say. Now what's the theoretical weight of the Purusha? Why do you need the Purusha for the analysis of the human being? And you don't, arguably. Because it's not the subject of first person predicates, but it's that which is liberated in this state of isolation. And I think that the Purushas are also all pervading, which is an odd notion, if they're all separate, but they're also all pervading. What separates them out from each other? If they're all pervading, yeah, anyway, it's an odd idea. What is to me, but it might not be to you. So the Samkhya notion then is, and this is the backdrop behind yoga as well. So yoga, as we'll see next time, is the separation of the Purusha, the realization of the isolation of the Purusha. So there's a radical dualism then between, also the idea of in Samkhya is that there's reincarnation, the self, the Purusha, although it's all pervading, nevertheless reincarnates over and over again according to its actions. In a linga sharira, in the subtle body called the linga sharira. And what does that subtle body comprise of? It comprises the five subtle elements plus the five subtle elements, sound, touch, colour, taste, smell. Strange idea. Plus what it calls the inner instrument, which is the buddhi, the ahamkara, and the mind. So these eight elements comprise a subtle body which reincarnates over and over again. So the gross body gets left behind, and the subtle body comprising those elements carries on. The city of eight,
very quickly, duck it if it's irrelevant. My year 11 children keep asking, how is it that in Hindu belief a person can actually reincarnate, because they think of the Western material mechanism. You're tackling that, and I'm trying to get it in my head in such a way that I can convey it to them. And do you have a sort of pearl of summary that could put that in one sentence?
The Samkhya view is that
I can see all this, but I can't.
According to Samkhya, you reincarnate over and over again.
Yes.
But it's your subtle body that carries on. The gross body gets left behind.
That's the thing. The subtle body carries on.
Subtle body carries on. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Subtle body carries on. The subtle body comprises, according to Samkhya, these elements.
Mm.
The linga sharira, which... So the buddhi carries on, the ahankara and the mind, and also those subtle elements. So what's get left behind are the five senses, which they would, because they're associated with the physical body.
Mm.
And also the five action capacities. So on this diagram, those 10, which comprise are the physical body, and that gets left behind. But what carries on are the subtle body, which is these subtle elements plus the mind, the inner instrument. And the mind is, of course, the sixth sense. As the senses perceive objects independently of them, so the mind perceives mental objects. So it's very close to Buddhism in some ways. So as the in the fire sermon, if you remember, the eye perceives objects, and that gives rise to eye consciousness, and the ear perceives objects, and that gives rise to sound consciousness, and so on. So it's very similar in the Samkhya system here. Now the buddhi, so the subtle body carries on, and the buddhi is part of this. Or a matter of interest, that the old Samkhya also analyzes bodies into those which are born from a womb, those which are born from moisture or sweat, svenja, and those which are egg-born or seed-born. And that also feeds into Buddhism. They have a similar analysis. And the Buddhi itself comprises eight fundamental predispositions or bhavas, which are dharma, jnana, knowledge, vairagya, dispassion, aishwarya, majesty or power, and their opposites. And it's through the dispositions of dharma one transmigrates the higher form. So these predispositions within the Buddhi control to some extent where the body is reborn, where the linga sharira transmigrates to. It's quite a complex analysis. Also the pratyayas, which I'll leave you to read on your own. You can read about these in the Samkhya Karikas 23 and 24. So Samkhya is really the first philosophy within Hinduism, really, the first systematic philosophy. And the Samkhya system is, although it has the philosophical problems within itself, such as what's the relation between the Purusha and the Prakriti, is the notion of the Purusha coherent in the sense that it's all-pervading, but is also individual and unique? And what is it that separates one Purusha out from another Purusha if they're all in quality, they're identical with each other, and they're not the subject of first-person predicate? So it's not the personality, but they're also all-pervading. And they're also isolated. So is that coherent, that notion? That, although there are philosophical questions there, it nevertheless is important. It pervades all later philosophical speculation. The Advaita Vedanta takes on board the Samkhya system. Tantra particularly is pervaded by the Samkhya system, and the Shaiva systems add their own 11 further tattvas to the 25 Samkhya tattvas. As we'll see in a few weeks. In terms of books about Samkhya, there's Gerald Larson's standard book, Classical Samkhya, and then he's written and edited Samkhya, which is one volume in the Encyclopedia of Indian Philosophies, which is very good, very thorough, I think. There's a very interesting use of Samkhya in K.C. Bhattacharya, who was a philosopher, Indian philosopher, in the mid 20th century, who wrote a very interesting book, Studies in Samkhya, who's a phenomenologist really, but he reads Samkhya in through the lens of phenomenology in a way. He's a very important and underrepresented philosopher, K.C. Bhattacharya. And there's a more recent book by Mikhail Burley called Classical Samkhya and Yoga, an Indian Metaphysics of Experience, which is very well worth reading, because he takes Samkhya seriously as a philosophy and looks at it in relation to Western philosophy, particularly Kant. And there's Cowell's translation of Madhava's text, the Compendium of All Philosophies, which I'd urge you to look at as well, the section on Samkhya in there. Some people find Samkhya terribly boring and dry. I probably wouldn't disagree.